Lancaster Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKesserJane.com. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Hallie Kesser-Jane. Today on the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show, joining me at my table are two well-respected thought leaders, the author of Everyday Bias, Howard K. Ross, and the author of Unretirement, Chris Farrell. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKesserJane.com and a host of venues including Blog Talk Radio. And be sure to visit us at our newest home on iHeartRadio. Today, the Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Hello. I'm Hallie Kesser-Jane, host of The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern when I talk with the great artists, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Hallie Kesser-Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HallieKesserJane.com. As founder and chief learning officer of Cook Ross, Inc., Howard J. Ross has served for almost 30 years as an influential business consultant to hundreds of organizations worldwide, specializing in leadership, diversity, and organizational transformation. He is a recognized thought leader on exploring and addressing unconscious bias. He is the author of Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance. His latest book, Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives, takes a look at the reality that if we are human, we are biased and what we can do about it. Let's talk. So bias, I want to throw out some synonyms for the word you use in your title of your important and enlightening book, Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives. Prejudice, partiality, unfairness, preconceived notions, foregone conclusion, favoritism, predisposition, preconception. I mean, we are a one judgmental society. I mean, should we pack it up and just go home? I mean, we're the source. It's bizarre. And I guess where I want to go with this is the title suggests, can we identify and can we navigate our judgments in our daily lives? Is that really possible?
Well, you know, I think it's a great question, Hill. I think that the question that, you know, a lot of times people say to me, well, what's the difference between bias and prejudice or, you know, some of the other words you use? I'm not saying them, you know, I don't really quibble about those definitions. I mean, we could get into the dictionary definitions of them, but the bigger factor is we think about ourselves as human beings. We're always assessing people very quickly. You walk into a party by yourself and you're in a room of people who you don't know. You know, how do you decide who to walk up to and talk to? Very few of us do so randomly. Mostly we find somebody who looks appealing, who looks safe, who looks, you know, in some way draws us towards them. The same thing is true in a meeting. Who do you choose to sit next to when you walk in the meeting? And that's because the human mind is designed to scope out our environment and determine what's safe. It's a fundamental survival mechanism. So there's nothing wrong with the fact that we do that. The challenge, of course, is that sometimes that can be very helpful. And as we've seen all too recently, sometimes it can be dramatically harmful.
So it's fair to say that bias is just a part of the human landscape, so to speak. It's quote unquote normal. So we're awful and that's that? Talk to me. It is normal, right?
Well, it's absolutely normal. It's as normal to human beings as breathing. And we've had a tendency, of course, in our discourse to or in the sort of the narrative we've created around it for bias to equal badness because we've only looked at one particular kind of bias. I mean, if we think about it, if you can imagine sort of a four-way grid, we might say that there's bias against things that is destructive, and we see that certainly when we see people who say, in its most blatant form, I'm not going to hire her for this job because she's a woman. That's a bias against something that's destructive. That person hasn't had a fair opportunity to get a job. Their bias is for things that can also be harmful. For example, if I hire somebody because they're a football player and therefore somebody else doesn't get a reasonable chance at a job, which has nothing to do with playing football, but I just kind of like football players or, you know, whatever. And there are also biases against things that can be very helpful. For example, when I make a quick determination that somebody is behaving in a threatening way towards me and therefore I'm able to get out of the way before they can harm me, that's very helpful. For example, I were to come up to you with a knife in my hand held over my head, you don't look at it and say, gee, I wonder what that is and what happens when she gets when he gets here. You know, you get quickly into protect and defend mode. And then there are also biases towards things that could be helpful. For example, I decide that I'm inclined to hire a particular kind of person for my organization, and it's very helpful to the organization because the fact that we've reached out and we've chosen to bring in people with this particular skill set or particular background because it helps us work with our clients or our customers, that sort of thing. So bias is neither bad nor good or necessarily harmful or helpful. The key here is when we're unconscious about how we're making these decisions, we might as well be rolling the dice, for example, as to who we hire.
So thought. So we've established that we all have these biases, even you. You know, I was amused by something. I was reading last week, I think it was, a New York Times story, that op-ed that you wrote.
Yes.
You told your own story about meeting a character on a plane. Would you share that? Because I think it's a perfect example of how crazy we all can be about this.
Yes, exactly. And the reason, by the way, just even before I share this story, Hallie, the reason I share those stories, and it's not the only one, have things like that happen all the time once you begin to see it, is because I want people to realize I'm not here wagging a finger at people and saying we're bad for having these thoughts. It's we all do this, including me. I was working in Jackson, Mississippi at Jackson State University for a couple of days, and I had to fly up to New York to work with another client. I had to go through Memphis, Tennessee, and when I landed in Memphis and headed to the gate to transfer for my transfer flight, I got to the gate and the gate attendant came on and said that there'd be a 45-minute delay in the flight. And as soon as she said those words, I hear a voice boom out from behind me. "You talking to us, lady?" And I turn around and there's a guy sitting behind me who I would best describe as Santa Claus with an attitude. He's a big, you know, white guy, white hair, white beard, well-fed, wearing overalls, flannel shirt, with a car magazine in his hand. And I kind of chuckled to myself and had him pegged. And the gate attendant was an African-American woman. And I sort of, you know, kind of rolled my eyes, so to speak, and it went about working on my computer until it was time to get on the plane. And I get on the plane, and sure enough, who's sitting next to me but angry Santa Claus? So we sort of acknowledge each other, you know, the nod that we do when we get on airplanes with sitting next to people, and then went about our business. And I was working on my computer on a course that I was leading the next week at Georgetown University, and he was reading his magazine, and at some point gets up to go to the bathroom and comes back and says, "What are you, a professor or something?" And I noticed a little threat response in my brain popped up, and then I just said, "No, I'm just teaching a course." And all of this continued until it came time to get to New York and begin our initial descent, when we have to close computers. And for travelers who are listening, know that this is when we have a tendency to start airplane chat, because it's now safe to get into a conversation you're not going to get roped into for 2 hours. And I turned to him and I say, "So what takes you to New York?" And he says, "I've got a professional meeting." And I said, "Really, what do you do?" He says, "I'm a radiologist," which didn't exactly fit my picture. And then I said, "Really, what kind of radiology are you interested in?" He gets very animated, and he says, "Well, actually, we're doing this very cool stuff with functional magnetic resonating imagery, and we're discovering that certain parts of the brain respond differently when people interact with different kinds of people." In other words, he's studying exactly the thing I'm most interested in. And had I not pegged him as Angry Santa the car mechanic, I might have learned more in a, you know, an hour and a half conversation with him than I did in 2 months of research on my book. So I just share that with people just to say that this is what we do as human beings. And, you know, even spending 30 years doing this work, it's still there, and it's still the way that we tend to process the world.
But I think that truly for me, I mean, it's a great story and it's amusing to boot. But on top of that, it's this, that you have to be open to understanding your own biases. You have to be able to say, you have to like grow up and say, you know what? I have these. Let me recognize them. then maybe I have some control over them, correct?
Yes, exactly. And that's really the first step for people in understanding how to manage these more effectively. If we live as if we're not supposed to have bias or only bad people have bias, then we have no hope whatsoever of seeing these in ourselves except by the random accident that something happens to come to our attention. But for the most part, of course, that's not going to happen with most people. If, on the other hand, we recognize that bias is a natural way that we process our interactions, not only with people, but with decisions in general, then we can come into the conversation with not, do I have bias, but which of my biases are operating in this circumstance and are they helpful or not? And with the clients we're working with right now, we're finding that that's tremendously helpful, that people are finding that when you begin to have conversations in that context, that they begin to notice things and be able to engage with them. And that one important component of this, too, is that it's non-defensive. In other words, this doesn't mean you're a bad person. You don't need to feel guilty about it, but simply pay attention to it and make the best decisions you can.
Two things come to mind in response. One would be this. Bias works on us in a very insidious way, and it comes in through the back door. You may not even be aware of the things that you're doing. And I want to speak to that in terms of personally, some of the things, ways that you see that affecting our personal relationships even. Can you do that?
Oh, well, there's no question about it. I mean, look, if we think about it from the standpoint of relationships between men and women, for example, that show up even in personal relationships, you know, how many times have we heard somebody either, and I'm talking now, of course, about heterosexual relationships, but, you know, how many times have we heard somebody complain about their husband and say, men? Or somebody complain about their wife, women. You know, we have a tendency to generalize, and particularly at times of stress, we tend to go to those kinds of places. And so as a result of that, there's this sense that I'm taking the stereotypes and as a way of dealing with my upset in a particular situation, I take those and I generalize them to that particular group as opposed to dealing with them just as an individual.
Right. And serves nobody.
Exactly. Because when we do that, we're no longer dealing with the person in question. We're now objectifying.
Exactly.
And since nobody particularly likes to be objectified, it's not a very successful way to have an interaction or a relationship.
Right. By the same token, we all have conscious biases and unconscious biases. You raise an interesting point, by the way, in Everyday Bias. I don't want to say the title again, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives, that focusing attention on combating our conscious biases may not necessarily always be a good thing.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Did I lose you? I think it was in the intro. That focusing attention on combating our conscious biases may not always be a good thing.
Oh, right. That what I'm saying is that it's not that it is a bad thing. It's just that thinking that we can turn biases off and on, that trying to make them go away is can sometimes be surprisingly ineffective, because when we think biases are bad and we try to make them go away, what we often do is actually drive them more deeply underground. You know, the human mind's an interesting thing. If we believe that biases are bad and we recognize it, or we see something that looks like a bias, we usually do one of two things. We'll either pretend it wasn't there, or we'll try to justify it. Well, the only reason I felt that way about that person was because blah, 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 you know. And a lot of that comes from the guilt that we've associated with biases. So, you know, only bad people have biases. Therefore, if I have a bias, I must be a bad person. And correspondingly, if I know that I'm not a bad person, if I know that I'm a good person and that I try to do good things and treat people well, then this must not be a bias. And in fact, of course, it doesn't work that way at all. We know that in fact, 90% or 80 to 90% of things that happen in organizations that differentially impact one group versus another are not things that people do because they wake up in the morning and say, I want to suppress women or I want to suppress people of color. They're things that people do thinking that they're behaving in a way that's completely appropriate. Let me give you an example real quickly. Let's say that two people come into an interview. I'm interviewing both of them. One of them will call Sally and the other will call John. Sally comes in the morning and I meet her. And my first impression of her is there's something about this woman that I like. Now, I had that thought 10 seconds after meeting her. Now, obviously, it can't be something about her because I haven't even known her long enough for it to be about her. I'm more than likely projecting something onto her. Maybe she reminds me of somebody from my past who I had a positive relationship with. But regardless, I ask her the first question of the interview, and she hems and haws a little bit. And without even thinking about it, I say, Sally, take a breath. It's just an interview. Let me ask the question again. Out of my affinity for her, I want her to succeed, so I give her that second chance. And then she nails it, and she the interview goes great, and you know, I'm making eye contact, I'm laughing at her jokes, and the interview goes very well. And 6 hours later, John comes in, and it's not even, let's see, sometimes it could be that I have a negative first impression of him, but let's say it's more benign than that. I'm distracted. You know, my mind is on something else because I just came from a meeting. And I asked John the first question of the interview, and he hems and haws a little bit. And this time, I just stand there with my arms crossed. Or even worse, I make a quick glance at my watch, like, that he's not supposed to see. And based on nothing more than that, he's now sweating bullets. And those two interviews go two completely different directions based on that initial 10 seconds. The next day somebody asked me, and I recommend Sally, of course, and don't even realize that I've had anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, if you put me on a lie detector test and asked me if I've interviewed them fairly, I would swear to you that I did. I would tell you that I used the same structured interviewing questions, gave them the same amount of time, and I have no idea that I've contributed anything to this, and I would pass that lie detector test. And so my experience has been that most of the biases we see occur in ways like that, things that people subtly do without even realizing how their behavior actually is having a dramatic impact on what's going on, and more likely simply associated with the other people that they're seeing.
Now, but that makes me want to say to you, so if you're the person being interviewed and you're sensing this, what do we learn? How do we react?
Well, it's difficult because, of course, when we're the person being interviewed, we're coming in with our own biases as well. We read people's body language in a particular way. We have our own sensitivities, and particularly when we're being interviewed, we often are feeling very insecure ourselves because we want to do well, and we, you know, project any number of various things on the particular person we're interviewing. And so it's difficult to read people. I mean, I think we've all had the experience. I know I recently had an experience. I was speaking at a conference, and there was a guy sitting and they had, you know, 150 people in the room maybe, and there was a guy sitting at the far back table. Everybody else was sitting in these circular tables with other people. He was sitting by himself at a far back table. He was about a 50-year-old white guy who was in a sport jacket and slacks with a tie at a conference where most people were dressed more casually. And he had a complete lack of affect on his face, completely flat affect, just listening there, occasionally typing things into his iPad. And I just assumed that somebody had told him to come there, and he didn't seem to have any interest. Then I get back to my room later that evening after doing whatever I did at the conference, and there's a note to me through LinkedIn, a request to connect from this guy saying that this was the best presentation on diversity and inclusion he'd ever seen, and he wanted to talk with me about the possibility of coming and doing some work with the leadership team of the bank that he belongs to. Or that he's an officer in, and I find out that he's a gay man who's married to an African-American and has two children that they've adopted together. So, completely different picture than I would have expected, but nonetheless, that's what his reality was. And so, you know, we do make stuff up about people, and I think it's important for us to recognize that this is occurring on both sides.
Oh, I think that's absolutely brilliant. You know, it's funny, I was just thinking, I talk to people who I've never met all day long, every day, right? That's what I do. And it's interesting And it's interesting to me, from my end, from their end, a voice can set you off.
Absolutely.
There are these subtleties, and then it's my business. I feel it. And when I feel it, you know, I work like a dog to say, no, calm down. You know, I'm not threatening, you know, whoa, we can do this. It's a fascinating thing, this thing that goes on between humanity. There's an oddity in all of this as well that you point out, which is intended harm or unintended harm. The results are the same.
That's correct. And it's important for us to distinguish between intent and impact in that regard. I mean, a lot of times when somebody comes to us and say, hey, I was really offended by what you said, and my response is, well, I didn't mean anything by it, as if that changes the fact that they were offended. I say to people, it's sort of like if I'm cleaning my gun and the gun accidentally goes off and it shoots somebody next to me, the hole in them is no different than if I aimed and shot. You know, it's still there. On the other hand, we do know that the impact on people, and studies are showing us this, that the impact on people is different when people know that it was intentional. And so when we attribute intent, we tend to it tends to hit us harder than when we know somebody didn't mean to do something. So it's important to clarify impact, but it's also important to recognize that the fact that you didn't intend something doesn't inherently mean that it didn't harm somebody.
Here's another place I want to go with you, Howard. This thought crossed my mind, and that is that we can be biased against our own biases, right?
I mean, biased against our own biases?
Yeah, that we want to hold on to some, maybe. Some we're attached to.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. We get very attached, and oftentimes no amount of data that we see will change our mind about that. Watch the news and what's going on around us right now and see how, depending upon the politics of a particular news report, they gather data to support an already existing point of view. You know, I was watching the protests last night. I was on the airplane flying back home from Chicago, where I was working with some clients yesterday, and I was watching, and I was flipping back and forth between MSNBC and Fox News, which I have a tendency to do because, you know, usually I'll flip between three or four stations because I'm so clear how
right.
The media that we watch supports our biases. And I did, as you know, part of the book I talk about how bias affects the political system, for example, and the choices we make around elections. And I did a lot of research around that back in 2012. And since then, it's really changed the way I watch the news. And I was watching, and of course, you know, MSNBC and Fox are very clearly politically different around these issues. And Fox interviewing people on the street who are protesting, and the person they come up to is a young woman who's probably 15 years old, a young African-American woman, and says, why are you out here? Why do you think this is about race? And she says, well, I don't know. It just is. And they say, and this is the kind of background that the protesters bring. This is the kind of foundation. And then MSNBC is doing something similar, but the person they're interviewing sounds like somebody who's probably a college professor who could do a treatise on race. And that's their expression of it. And both of them are somewhat extreme from the overall group of people who are out on the street. You know, one probably much more informed than the average person, the other much less informed than the average person. But both of them fit the political narrative that these particular shows and these particular stations and reporters were trying to create. And I think that this is not at all unusual. We'll have a tendency to see it that not only the newscasters do that, but we do it as well.
You're so right. And I'm like you. I have them all going on because it's so clear how much each one has, you know, its intent as to what they want us to see based on their biases and where they're coming from. And I think that's a big problem in this country, that until we eliminate that somehow, that what, you know what I'm saying? It's just so crazy how we've gotten so polarized in owning our biases. It's very bizarre. Can it be eradicated completely? And let me ask that this at the same time, is it something that happens over generations?
Well, I mean, let me say this. I mean, we will never eradicate, I mean, never is a long time, who knows how human beings will evolve over generations, but over centuries, but it's not likely that we'll ever eradicate the human tendency to have bias, because it's important for us to realize that bias is not a bad thing. It's a necessary function of the human mind, and if we think that we can get rid of it, we're fooling ourselves, because if we didn't have bias, how would we function in the world? You know, every decision, every person we encounter, we would have to newly take it on, and it would just make life very dangerous and very untenable. And so it's not only likely that we won't get rid of bias, it's not even advisable for us to get rid of bias entirely. However, the content of biases clearly does change over time. I mean, if we just look at what's going on right now around marriage equality, we could certainly see that, Hallie. I mean, in 10 years, we've gone from a significant majority of the population being against marriage equality to a significant majority of the population being in support of marriage equality. And that's happened right before our eyes, faster than almost any other civil rights movement we've ever seen. So the notion that we're going to get rid of it is not likely. But what is likely is that those biases will change over time and will develop different biases. If you see in your children or in the next generation, it's not that they don't have bias. They may just have bias about different things.
I think what you're saying in one sense, though, is that it's kind of built into us, kind of like fear of fight and flight is built into us.
Yes, exactly, which is an essential way for us to deal with life. And if we think about the way the mind is constructed and has evolved over time, you know, you begin to realize that the people that our ancestors who were more cautious about other people were likely to survive more. You know, if you were somebody who just ran up to a group of people around the water hole and said, hey, how you doing, 40,000 years ago or whatever, you were likely killed by an opposing tribe member. If, on the other hand, you were somebody who hid behind a tree and checked them out first and be sure that they were friendly, friend versus foe, you likely had a better chance of surviving. So as a result of that, from an evolutionary standpoint, we probably have a greater tendency to be spawned from people who are a little bit more cautious than a little bit more reckless. And so we're designed to be cautious, and there's nothing wrong with that. I say to people all the time, my job is not to tell you who to hire or anything like that. It's more to help you be more conscious about those decisions, how you make them.
You told me a story I'm going to share one with you. I was recently out with a friend, a guy friend. Mm-hmm. We were at a bar and we were talking politics, my favorite conversation. And he says to me, you know, we were talking about the difference between the, you know, the two parties, so to speak. And he said, I'm sitting in this bar. I'm telling you that I can tell you every person in this room who was a Republican, who was a Democrat. This is a true story. And so I said, let's have at it. You'll buy me a great drink when we're done because you can't possibly do it. Darn if he didn't do it. How bizarre is that, right? That's stereotyping. Yeah. And that's a part of this, isn't it?
Yes, of course. And again, we stereotype for a reason. It's part of this whole system is sort of a human danger detector system, if you will. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't exist if it didn't have value and benefit to it for us. If it didn't, you know, it's like anything else, a cost benefit analysis. You know, yes, there's a cost to this, but there's also a benefit to it. It makes life easier. It makes life quicker. It also tends to keep us safer. And if you do believe in the notion that better to be safe than sorry, and that most people are more cautious than they are reckless in most areas of their life that are important, then you can see how identifying stereotypes of who's dangerous, that is negative stereotypes, is far more likely than positive stereotypes. And we know that that's the case because we can watch the functions of the brain that associate with negative versus positive stereotypes. And we can see that the amygdala is far more sensitive to threat when it's coming our way than it is towards positive rewards that are coming our way. And again, that's logical. If I miss a reward that's coming my way, nice surprise. If I miss a threat that's coming my way, dead. So, you know, clearly the margin of error is far greater when it's on one side than the other.
You know, we've been talking about this whole conversation about the mind and the explanation of its patterns as a result of, I think, a certain kind of indoctrination, because that's what we're indoctrinated into, what we believe. I mean, you know, you're born Jewish, except that's what you're dealt with, like your hand, right? You're born this way, you would. And few people, you know, go off the rail of what they have been, what has been imposed upon them. But I think that we have to have this also discussion in the context of spirituality, because I think in a way, isn't it partly a spiritual conversation as well?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been somewhat of a student of Eastern religions now for you know, close to 20 years, maybe 15 or 20 years, and I certainly in studying Buddhism, I'm not a Buddhist. I mean, I don't have the discipline that it takes to be a Buddhist, but I've certainly gotten value out of learning certain things from Buddhism. And it's interesting when you look at the brain research now. I mean, you look at the things that the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. You know, for example, the Buddha, you know, famously said, "What I observe in myself, I am not." That is, if I can watch myself in action, I'm less likely to be automatic about my behavior. Well, this is now foundationally, you know, the brain science is proving this to be true, that when we develop the concept of metacognition, that is the ability to watch ourselves think, or, you know, we can have thoughts like, what made me think about that? But that requires us to come to the prefrontal neocortex of the brain, because that's where metacognition lives. The prefrontal neocortex is a much less reactive, responsive part of the brain. This is what Daniel Kahneman, you know, the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, who won the Nobel Prize in Behavioral Economics, called the slow brain or system two thinking. Whereas the part of us that quickly reacts to somebody, that makes something up about somebody very fast, the fast brain is in the limbic system, which is far more of a reactive, protective brain. So here you have something that somebody said 2,500 years ago in a spiritual context, and in fact, it's being shown to be true in terms of the brain science behind it. And I think it's you know, it's no accident that things become perennial wisdom, that when things last for thousands of years, they can all be misused, of course, but they often are foundationally, you know, found in you know, that when we look at them, they're it's not all unusual that we find that there's some foundation of reality or fact in them that caused them to stick around for so long.
I definitely think that you can't have this conversation without saying that as well. So listen to me. Are we becoming more of a viva la difference society? Is that what this is all about, really?
Are we becoming more of a what? I'm sorry.
A viva la difference. We are different.
Yes.
Long live the difference.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't think we have much of a choice. You know, we're living in a society that's becoming more diverse all the time. And if you look just at American society, for example, back in mid-1960s, 78% of, when we hit our 200 millionth American, 78% declared themselves as white. It's now, predicted by most demographers that by 2050, that number will be, you know, in the mid-40s. You know, that's demographic change that's revolutionary. We've never seen change like that anywhere historically, other than places where people may have come out and wiped out another population. And so we don't have any rule book for knowing how to do this. We do know that that's going to continue to change, and whether people like it or not is irrelevant. And this is really important for us to get. You may not like the fact that diversity is coming. It doesn't matter whether you like it. It's here. It's going to be here. And so the question is not, do you like it? The question is, how are we going to deal with it in a way that keeps us moving forward as a culture and as organizations?
I think that's a good place to end. Lots of thought in that. Thanks, Howard.
Oh, Hallie, it's been my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Howard K. Ross, the diversity guru and the author of Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives by way of Roman and Littlefield. You can discover more about Mr. Ross and his work at cookross.com. Chris Farrell is a senior economics contributor at Marketplace, American Public Media's nationally syndicated public radio business and personal finance programs. He is also economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. An award-winning journalist, Chris is a contributing editor for Bloomberg Businessweek and a personal finance columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. His eye-opening, thought-provoking, and surprisingly inspirational new book on retirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life, takes a look at the dire warnings about an older American workforce, but is a book for all ages. Let's talk. I have to tell you what an interesting book this is, Chris. Unretirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life. This really is quite a different take on all those doom and gloom prognosticators who tell us the boomers are going to put America out of business, if not themselves. So let's begin with, listen to me, the conventional concept of retirement. The concept to you is, ironically, an old idea.
Well, it is this idea that, you know, as people get older, they become more useless. I mean, they're nice people. You like them being around, and you can kind of have a conversation with them. But when we think about things like, you know, being productive, dynamic, being engaged in the workplace, you don't automatically think about the older worker or the aging boomer. And instead, we have this image that's been driving so much of our public conversation about an aging population, that we're just going to have too many of these old people. The economy's not going to be that dynamic. Too few young people supporting too few old people. You know, there just isn't going to be retirement savings, and this is going to make it hard to pay for Social Security. And it's like, you know, that baby boomer legend, Hunter Thompson, you know, fear and loathing about an aging population.
It is kind of bizarre. But there's another aspect to that, to this, and that there appears to be a bit of a fallacy as to what some thought were going to be their golden years, retire to the Sun Belt, sit around the pool, play a little golf, live forever. But that hasn't proven to be the golden calf people thought it was going to be for everyone. So that there is this new concept that you've come up with about unretirement. Life goes on. What?
Life goes on. And, you know, if you think about it, and it makes a lot of sense. For many people, you know, you've worked all your life, and some of us have gone in and out of the workforce, but you worked all your life. You've gained these skills. You've gained this knowledge. You've gained this experience. And you also have colleagues. You have people that you're around. I mean, work is a social institution. You know, people get excited when someone has a baby, and they get upset when someone gets divorced, and someone actually cares whether or not you show up. And then all of a sudden, almost arbitrarily, one day, you're going to say goodbye to all that, and then you're never going to work again. And you're going to, you know, we use the cliche, you know, you're going to go play golf or get in an RV or, you know, live the patio culture. And that has just turned out to be a dissatisfying life for many people. And the reason is boomers are well-educated. Boomers are healthier than previous generations. And so what it turns out for many people, they want to stay engaged. They still want to earn an income. They still want to go to work. They don't want to be working 40 to 60 hours a week anymore. That's true. But they don't want to walk away and never work again.
Well, that makes sense to me. I can't imagine just sitting here and counting parakeets flying over my head.
Well, I mean, think about what you're doing now. So here's your work. Now, if we were in the 1950s and you were working in a factory, or you were a minor, we'd be having a different conversation. But if you think about where's all the job growth in our society, it's largely been in sort of the information-intensive sectors, the service sector, the social sector. So actually, you know, this desire to be working more, changes in our economy make it much more practical.
Well, I think we are an inventive group, us baby boomers, we baby boomers. And speaking of we baby boomers, who are the largest segment of the population, who have initiated so many changes.
Yes.
Thank you, Hunter Thompson. Right. Supposedly healthier, as you say, and we're going to live longer than previous generations, we hope, we think. But does that mean American society is aging? And of course, that does create this thing. You know, the budget battles of the last couple of years, pretty amazing. Social Security, Medicare, we're told that they are running out. You know, when I think about some of these people who are out there hawking this whole thing, you know, making the baby boomers almost guilt-ridden, don't you?
Yeah.
dare go out and continue to work or whatever, because you're going to throw us all off base, and you know, you're takers and you're moochers. And then there are people like Pete Peterson, you know, talk to me. I mean, are these I can't say the word right now. I'm getting myself so aggravated about this, because it really is something that irritates the heck out of me. I sit there and I go, why are these things truly going to happen?
No. And here's the thing. Part of what I got interested in this area is just what you're saying. It didn't make sense to me. And the impact of people working longer is dramatic on household finances, and it's dramatic on our economy. And if people are working longer, even part-time work, and they're paying taxes, and they're continuing to contribute to society, a lot of these things that people worry about, the bill gets easier to pay. I mean, if people work longer, society is richer, households are richer, employers are better off, the tax coffers are full, and it becomes much easier to pay those bills for Social Security and Medicare. So I think our public policy discussion should turn 180 degrees away from this dire demographics of aging and more think about, okay, so what incentives can we put out there that would encourage people to work longer, that would make it easier for people to work longer, that even as people have some disabilities, that they can continue to work longer? Because one of the things that has been really striking in my reporting is so many people that have disabilities, they want to continue to work. They want to continue to earn a paycheck. And rather than saying, well, you got a disability, so you know, you're out of the workforce, let's figure out ways so that they can continue to work and can continue to contribute to society and continue to pay taxes.
And that is so interesting, because I think that there's so much of a negative meme going out there. You know, we're all bums. You know, everybody's collecting disability because they don't want to work. Everybody's, you know, leaving their job because they're looking for a way out. I think that, again, is really so negative. Where is this coming from? We have to change this, no? I mean,
we have to change this, and there's a meanness out there which I don't truly understand, and yet it's also true in doing my reporting, and you probably have the same experience, you know, this rethinking the last third of life. There's a conversation going on, but it's very much a grassroots conversation, and it's happening in metropolitan areas, it's happening in rural areas. You have people who are struggling with this or trying to think this through. When you get to the state capitals, but certainly when you get to Washington, D.C., this is not part of the national conversation. But it's going and it's growing, and there are more nonprofit organizations getting into it. There are more for-profit organizations getting into it. And I think it's gathering momentum. And what's going to be the surprise is that at some point over the next couple of years, so many people who are aging are going to be involved in this that it's going to change our national conversation. When I talk to people, you might have had this experience. You know, 10 years ago, when I mentioned working longer, people would roll their eyes. Thanks, Chris. Great. I'm going to be the best job I'm going to be able to get is a greeter at a big box retailer. And now you have conversations with people and they go, well, what kind of opportunities are out there? What could I be doing? Why are there organizations that I should be tapping into? And so the conversation, even 10 years, has changed.
I believe that. But I do think there's a reality that we do have to address, and that is retirement, first of all, isn't a possibility for everybody. Some people really have to continue to work, yet they don't always have that opportunity. But before we address that reality, I think we have to talk about people of a certain age. In America, seniors do not get the respect they deserve. Right. We have to discuss this reality of ageism and age discrimination, which is really, I have to say, inherently American and inherently something new, because when I was growing up, that wasn't the way it was. We actually changed it, I think, when we started the stuff about, the, you know, if you're over 30, you're dead. Do you know what
I'm saying? By the way, I just want to say he's still playing. He's still singing Satisfaction at 70, whatever.
I love it.
You know, you got to put these things in context.
Well, you know, we aren't going down easily. I'll tell you that. That's for sure about this. But let's talk about this, because I do think that this is part of the reality that needs to be altered.
Age discrimination is absolutely real. So if you're in, if you think about in an organization, when people say, hey, you know, we need to, we got a problem here. We got to get some innovative, creative people in here. No one's automatically thinking about the 60-year-old. They're thinking about the younger generation. But here's the thing. This is a stereotype. It is nothing but a stereotype. We have enormous amounts of scientific evidence, research, and just sort of the evidence of, you know, some, you know, Matisse did this great artwork in the 70s and 80s. But it's just not just Matisse. You can go through all kinds of fields, and whether it's law, it's the art, it's painting, and you find example after example of people who continue to grow and continue to do some of their best, most creative, innovative work later in their life. And so what we're dealing with is a prejudice. And over time, prejudices change as more and more people demonstrate, more people show in the workplace, in their volunteering, and what they're doing, in their engagement, that this is nonsense. You'll fall by the wayside. The analogy that I would draw, and we still have to make more progress, but the most powerful social movement in the United States in the post-World War II era was the women's movement. And if you go back to the early 1980s, so we're past some of the stuff where some of the really horrible discrimination, there's some important lawsuits, but still, there was a lot of discrimination against women. And basically, it took a long period of time, we still have farther to go, to break down those barriers, but women really did. Age discrimination is the same thing. It's a stereotype, it's a prejudice, and older folks can be just as creative as younger people. They need to be given the opportunity.
And they need to say, I'm not gonna take this anymore from a window in a movie. I'm just.
Well, that's how they do age themselves, because they do still remember that.
Right.
And you can be having a conversation with a younger generation, and they'll kind of look at you like
rolled eyes. What are you talking about? That? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I'm also thinking about this. There is something called forced retirement. I mean, yeah. certain companies. I think law. You know, they have an age, and you're out of it. But there are other things that happen. And what do you do about that?
Well, I think for many people, what it turns out is we have moved toward a society where forced retirement is now the exception, not the rule. Now, what does happen is, you know, we have a very volatile economy where we lay people off very quickly, and a lot of older workers lose their jobs that way. But the forced retirement because of age, that's actually become the exception. But here's the heartening thing. One of the things that comes out is many people who have worked and they have skills and they have experience, they're a little bit burned out on what they've been doing. And what they want to do is sort of recharge their batteries by taking the skills, the knowledge, the experience, what they know. And you mentioned a lawyer. So you're a lawyer. And take that into a different sector of the economy. And there's a certain reassurance that comes from using your existing skills, using your knowledge, but it's also kind of fun. It's energizing to be around different people, different sort of challenges. And so this is why you're seeing so many people move from the for-profit sector to the not-for-profit sector later in their life, because they want to give back. They still want to earn an income, but they're trying to take their skills into a different sector of the economy to address some of our biggest problems in our society.
I like the sound of that. And I also like the sound of the fact that this is very entrepreneurial and creative. Yeah. And it takes that kind of chutzpah to maybe move into something, create something. It doesn't have to be, the tech kids who are creating. Our minds are still working, thank you very much. Yes, talk to me about that a little bit.
If you mention entrepreneurship, we automatically think about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, or Jack Dorsey and Twitter, or for an earlier generation, what was it, Bill Gates and Microsoft, the late Steve Jobs. And we associate entrepreneurship with youth. But if you look at the numbers, about a quarter of all new businesses are formed by the 55 to 64 year age group.
Isn't that extraordinary?
15%.
Yeah, let me just interrupt on that, because I want you to repeat that, because that is the most that's an extraordinary.
A quarter of all new businesses are now created by the 55 to 64 year age group, and that's up from 15% in 1996. Now, most of these businesses are in an earlier era, we would have said, you know, hang out, you're single. Now it's create your own website. But, you know, these typically are small. Maybe they have one other employee. A lot of times they're sort of informal partnerships that they work with. But these are people of skill. They have knowledge. They earn an income. They're creating a business. And typically what they're doing is they're taking advantage of one of the real assets that an older worker has, which is their network, their contacts, their knowledge, their experience. So they go off, they set up their own business, maybe they got laid off and they can't get another job because, as you mentioned, you know, you lose your job at 55, it's pretty tough to get a job. You lose your job at 60, it's tough to get another job. And so part of this new business creation is making the best of a bad situation. But part of it is a lot of people have had this dream of starting their own business. And, you know, they kind of had it. They don't want to have a boss anymore. They want to be their own person. And so, and they have skill and they have knowledge. They say, you know what, I can do this. And I'm maybe not going to make much money, but what the surveys show is that people who own their own business are happier than people who are employees.
Oh, for sure. Nice to answer to yourself and not somebody else. Let me just take this out just off what we're talking about just for a second, just to throw this wrench into our conversation. And that is, I hear a lot of talk, particularly amongst the young, that their options are narrowed by the keeping older workers in the workforce.
Right.
Is this real or is this not?
It's really not true. And this is one of the things where economists have done a lot of work. Because it's a natural thing to think is that, of course, you know, if older workers are continuing to work, that's less opportunity for young people. And it's called the lump of labor theory. And it's basically been completely disproved. But there's a couple other things going on, you know, once you adjust for the business cycle and stuff. There are a couple things else going on, though. A lot of this, I want to work longer, does not mean that I want to continue to work at the place that I've been with. In fact, there are a lot of people, as we mentioned earlier, have a strong desire to go do something else. So I think there's going to be a lot of movement. I mean, we've gone through a very tough people where if you had a job, you weren't very comfortable leaving it, right? I mean, you kind of wanted to stay there because this was a bad labor market, a bad economy. But now as the economy gets a little bit better, labor market gets a little better, you're starting to see a little more movement. So I think things are going to open up for people. But the more important point, the economy is not a zero-sum game. I mean, there's almost, if you draw this circle, and then people think the economy is a pie. So if more older workers are working, that means there's less opportunity for young people. But the economy expands. And I used to run into this, I don't know if you did, back in the early 1980s, and it would be people would think the economy's a pie, there's more young women coming out of college, and they're going to have careers, and that means there's less opportunity for men. And that wasn't true. Instead, what happened is the economy grew, and women contributing to the economy just helped the economy get bigger, and there more jobs were created than anyone imagined could have been created. So it's not a set pie. What can happen, like the period that we've been through, where things kind of freeze up for a while because everyone freezes and everyone's scared and people don't feel like leaving their company. But that's not how our economy normally works. And I think we're going back to a more normal economy.
Well, I hope so. And I hope so soon, because one of the big issues right now is the people working like crazy and getting paid not enough wage, you know, for inflation, for everything else that's going on. And, you know, the upper tier is getting a huge boost in their salary, and the rest of us poor people are working. Not so much. I'm not so much. And that's part, isn't that, you know, you're more of the economist than I ever would be. But I would assume that that's a lot of the problem right now. We've got to get, you know, wages.
Yes.
Up.
Yeah, a lot of our issues are about wages.
Being
that
frozen.
Wages have not grown relative to the wealth and the productivity of the economy for the average person like they did in the past.
Yeah.
And this is not a, you know, the recent 5 years period. This set in several decades ago. And it's reached a point where people are far more aware of it. It's a bigger problem. You can't just say, well, it's all going to get good once the economy continues to grow. That's a really big issue. Nevertheless, I think that it is also important to say, you know, this working longer, even earning a slim part-time income, is really important to the health of the nation, the health of the economy, but also to the health of a lot of people and adding to their savings and having a better standard of living in their elder years.
Right. You brought up women. I want to bring up women. The U.S. Department of Labor says women are likely to work part-time jobs jobs, and many don't qualify for retirement packages. And they took time off to raise children. They got divorced. They lived in sin and didn't have Medicare or whatever earned, you know, kind of thing. There's a big problem with women being out there with no safety net. And let me take it just a little bit further. They're notoriously conservative. We women are in investing. And I read that something like, 45% of the 62 million wage and salaried women ages 21 to 64 have participated in retirement plans. I mean, that's kind of a scary reality.
Right. Now, I don't know specifically about that data. I do know now, if you're looking at the younger generation, one of the more optimistic in the numbers is that, first of all, the younger generation is taking advantage of retirement savings plans at a faster rate than the previous generation, but women are also participating. Actually, I think is above the rate of men at this point. So that's one of those things that there seems to be a good swing going on. But that doesn't, you're absolutely right. Look, this working longer, there are segments of our society who, you know, have been in and out of the workforce or raising children, or more worrisome is people who never had a job that had a retirement savings plan at work. Yeah, right. Go set up an IRA on your own. That's pretty hard to do, actually. When money's tight, and never had an employer-sponsored health insurance package at work either. And, you know, and there are people who, you know, comes to be age 60, they don't, you know, their bodies are beaten down, their minds are beaten down, they're burned out, and, you know, cannot deny the reality of that. My argument is, don't deny the reality of that, and don't say to them, well, you're going to just have to work longer. The reality is, there's a majority of people who have the ability to work longer. If we make it so that they can work longer, the wealth that is created can provide the support and improve the support that goes toward the people who either can't work or are burned out or have lived on the margins of society. We're an extremely wealthy society, but the wealth created by those who can work longer can support the people who can't.
Oh, boy, that sounds like nice. I don't know. You know, we got a certain segment of our society right now that's not feeling very, nice. How you like that word? That's a choice of a word. On that same, you're talking here that we are actually in a transition from an old way to a new way. And I want to talk to you about getting that government involved in fortifying this transition. You think that needs to, and how?
Yes, I do think that it needs to. And part of where government can play an enormous role is on a couple levels. So if we're just looking right now, what are some things the government can be doing to encourage people to work longer? There's some really good ideas that are floating around in the sort of policy wonk circles, and they've been floating around for a long period of time, and I think they're really good ideas. And, you know, one is, let's say you've worked, comes from John Chauvin at Stanford University, and you've been working for 40 years. Well, at the end of 40 years, they just say, okay, you're paid up on Social Security. You no longer pay into Social Security. Your employer no longer pays Social Security. Well, that's a bump up in your pay, and you're cheaper to your employer, and it's a reward for continuing to work. I think that's a great idea. I love that kind of idea. On a more fundamental level, it is an absolute disgrace that 42% of private sector workers do not have a retirement savings plan at work. And one-third of households do not have access to a retirement savings plan at work. And that is a type of problem that we can solve extremely easily by putting some sort of opening up the federal government's thrift savings plan, which like was a terrific retirement savings plan to small businesses, or put a retirement savings plan on top of everyone's Social Security. But if you do that, if you make your retirement savings plan completely portable, so you have it no matter where you're working, and you're not dependent on your employer offering it, and the same thing with your health care, then you're going to unleash a lot of entrepreneurial opportunity, and you're going to reduce the risk of being 55 years old and losing your job. And so that's where government can make a huge difference.
Without getting into people's faces, a big issue is health care on a lot of levels. I mean, there's the problem, no job, no health care, which is in a way stymied people's working careers and retirement. You're a big fan of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes. I think the Affordable Care Act, you know, some of the criticisms are really legitimate. I think the Affordable Care Act is important on a couple levels. First of all, a Rubicon was crossed. And, you know, we've had this 100-year history going back to Teddy Roosevelt to try and create universal health insurance in the United States. And a Rubicon was crossed where we haven't achieved it, but it was recognized we're moving toward universal health care, and we have moved away from a world of pre-existing conditions. And we're not going back to a world of pre-existing conditions. No matter what anyone says, that is a Rubicon. We've crossed it. We're not going back. The other thing that I think is very important about the Affordable Care Act over the next 5 years, you know, it's important right now, but 5 years from now is when I get really excited, is the creation of the insurance markets. Because for the first time, we actually have a reasonably vibrant individual health insurance market, something that we've not had for a long time. The employer-sponsored health insurance market has been pretty good until recently, but the individual health insurance market was terrible. And I've done, you know, written on and talked about personal finance for years, and that was always a problem. You lose your job, and if you went into the individual insurance market, it was just costly and it wasn't a very good product. And this is really changing. And I think this is really going to change the dynamics of people feeling much more comfortable at age 55 to take a risk, to start a business, to lead their company and not stay locked in their company because they don't want to lose their health insurance.
I think it's a terrific thing. And I think it was necessary. And I think that it'll evolve. It was pushed through. It'll evolve to accommodate. It has to. There is no other way. And plus, it was saving the healthcare sector, which was such a drain on.
Can I just make one other
point? Sure, go for
healthcare,
it.
Which is, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the healthcare with Medicare and what's the future of Medicare. The Medicare future is looking much better. A lot of the reforms really are showing up on the price level, which I think is very optimistic. But Medicare is a subset of an overall issue about healthcare. I frankly would love to get rid of Medicare and just let's have a conversation about healthcare, whether you're a baby or you're 95 years old. It's all under healthcare. It all interacts with the other. Medicare came about because we could get universal health insurance coverage for the 65-plus population at that time, which we couldn't do it. We didn't. The votes weren't there to do it for everyone. I think with the Affordable Care Act is a step toward universal health care for everyone.
Oh, absolutely. And I frankly do not understand people objecting to that. I don't get it, but you know, I don't get a lot. I want to just take it from, because we're running out of time, but I have a few more questions that I got to get to. And one of them is about the spiritual component to this, because it is a sense of dignity and a sense of value and a sense of purpose and having a meaningful life and giving back. And when you're older and you're contributing to the workforce, it is something a little different than when you're young and you're doing it because of different reasons, you know?
You are. But one of the things that's really struck me is, you know, when you talk to a young college graduate and they're entering the workforce and they really want a job and they really want an income, but there's a real idealism there. You know, they want to do something that they feel proud about. And that's one of the things as adults, we look at what they're doing and we applaud that idealism. And the thing is, when I've been interviewing people in their 50s and 60s and 70s who are looking for some sort of encore, some sort of part-time job, some sort of contract labor, starting their own business, they're using the exact same language as that young college graduate. I want to do something I'm proud of. I want to do something that gives back. I want to do something where I feel I make a difference. And the only real difference between that older worker and that younger worker is that the older worker, time is short. The younger worker, time is infinity.
Interesting point of view. What about those who don't have the wherewithal or the financial backing to start something new? Where do they go? What do they do?
Well, what they're doing and what you can see is, you know, communities are incredibly powerful and people are incredibly creative. And we all have to deal with, and we all look at the numbers and, you know, higher income, middle income families, working class families, lower income families. But one of the things that's really striking is when you, as you get closer and you break through these numbers and you get into communities, there's just a lot more communal support. Now, not in certain neighborhoods where things have gotten so bad and there's no real economy there, but that's not that much of the United States. And so one of the things that really struck me, and I was at a talk in Eastern North Carolina in a rural area, largely Black, and a lot of the children had been leaving. And it was that, you know, the families would have five, six kids, and they'd grow up, and then they would take care of the elders. And then what was happening is the families are getting smaller. They had like three kids, and two would move to cities for more opportunities. And the churches stepped in, and the churches have become much more engaged in taking care of the elder and the volunteer work with the church. And so I think a lot of this turns out to be activities by our churches, by nonprofit organizations, by entrepreneurs who are out and make a profit, but they have a social conscience. And communities is really remarkably durable. And that's where activity goes on. That's where people find purpose, they find meaning. And the real thing to fight against is you want to fight for, let's say to fight for, is inclusion, that people have value, that there's work that can be done, and not turn them away and say, you're old, you're useless, you know what, just retire.
Exactly. I have to throw something out at you before we get to the last question, something that I actually saw on Bloomberg. Corporate directors are getting older and holding their seats longer while the workforce is getting younger. There's an irony in that.
There is, but what it also reflects, I think, is a fundamental shift in our society. And this I think, is a good shift, which is you have people who, as they age, are more and more engaged. I mean, think about what it used to mean to be rich. To be rich and to be successful meant leisure. You didn't work. You didn't have to work. Now, even the well-off are continuing to work, to continue to contribute, to continuing to be part of their society. So I think what they're partially doing is saying, you know, we have a society that values work, and even our wealthy have decided that leisure isn't all it's cracked up to be. Now, they do still are able to have leisure, but it's not all it's cracked up to be. So I actually think this is part of whether you're looking at Hollywood or you're looking at, the board of directors or where you're looking in our society, there's an increased appreciation of the contribution the elderly can make. Unfortunately, it has not entered into our common everyday discourse, but there are signs of it throughout our society.
And as to the youth of our country, time to re-educate them and teach them about an emerging new paradigm?
Yeah.
As well as educating them on the worth of our elders?
Yes.
I've been speaking with Chris Farrell, author of On Retirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life, by way of Bloomsbury Press. For more information about Chris and his work, visit his website at chrisfarrellblog.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.